Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, you'll hear Seth's interview with Anthony Atamanik, who portrays Donald Trump on Comedy Central's The President Show. And then Anthony takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. Then, Seth's conversation with filmmaker Brian Knappenberger. Now, let's go to Seth.
Our guest is a comedian and actor who stars as Donald Trump in The President Show. New episodes air Thursday nights on Comedy Central. Please welcome to the show, Anthony Atamanik, everybody. How are you, man?
I'm good.
Congratulations on this show. For those who haven't watched, and you really should immediately,
yes.
You play President Trump hosting a talk show.
Yes, yes.
And my dear friend, your dear friend, Pete Gross, plays Vice President Pence as sort of a sidekick.
The great, yeah, he's incredible as Pence.
And this is very exciting. How did it come about that, obviously, you had this impression.
Yeah.
And then how did you decide you wanted to do it as a talk show?
Well, I had done it at UCB, at Upright Citizens Brigade.
And how did it happen the first time, like, that you realized you had a Trump impression?
We were in ASCAT, and someone said, Mr. President, and I walked out, and it was 2 months after he announced, so I thought it would be funny. And it was probably very poor. I think I sort of was like, yes, and like, I didn't do anything great. And someone said, you should do a show. And so I wrote it in 7 days, and the core material for that ended up being sort of the touring piece I did with James Adomian, where he played Bernie.
You did a wonderful Bernie Sanders.
Trump versus Bernie. And then once he got elected, after I went into hiding for 3 weeks and was like, I can't believe I'm now trapped in this sort of like Faustian bargain with doing this, I thought, well, he always wanted to do TV. I think that's the reason he ran, was to renegotiate The Apprentice.
I agree.
And I really do. I think it was a renegotiate, and I think he then got stuck in it and was like, oh, no, I got to do this. And so I said, what would he do if he did Fireside Chats? And I thought of that scene when De Niro can't, in Casino, he can't work at the casino anymore, and they cut to him hosting that, like, awful talk show from the casino.
Yeah.
And I said, that's what he would do.
Yeah. Just an awful talk show.
An awful talk show.
And you...
but it's a great talk show.
Yes, it's a great comic talk show. You have said this about yourself, that you feel a little bit like Dustin Hoffman in the film Tootsie, where he was an actor who couldn't get work until he sort of dressed up as a completely different character.
Yes.
Is that the case for you?
I actually was not being able to get... I couldn't get a commercial. I found out someone took my role in Iceman Cometh. And so I ran across the street in a hip running across the street, New York move, and then yelled at my agent and then got... No, and so I'm a
redhead. But it's so funny because that would be what Donald Trump would say, is that if you embody him, success will come. And that happened for
you. It is kind of frightening when you think about it.
Yeah.
It is. There's a very sort of weird... I mean, doing Trump is like doing a drag act. Like, it is. Like, someone handed me photos backstage from a live piece I did, and, like, it is... I, like, learned myself how to do the makeup. It's very, like, a sad French film, like, me, like, in the... doing the makeup and like, putting the hair on. And I thought about the fact that he actually has to do that, and he can't pull the skin off.
Yeah.
He's stuck inside.
He's just fully stuck in this thing he's created.
Yeah.
You've said you sort of have three modes of your Trump impression, and it is, I mean, it really is so truly the most nuanced of the Trump impressions. And it's really beautiful to behold. What would you, how would you describe the three modes?
Well, I think that there's prompter mode. And I learned a new thing of why he hates the prompter. And I realized that when he stands at the podium and he has to go prompter to prompter, he shrugs like a kid in school. He's like, and then he reads, watch. The next time I watch him, he goes, like that. So prompter mode is like, you know, good night, moon, good night, cat, good night, baby with a rat. Like, it's very, like, he doesn't have any, he's like the Brown Reading Group. Then there's press conference Trump, which was today.
Yeah.
Which was just, I mean.
It was really, it was the most press conference Trump.
Well, he uses that excuse me like Excalibur. He's like, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. But he whispers. He whispers actually a lot in those. Like, rally Trump, he'll do like, he said today, he's like, but the Nazis, they had a permit. They had a permit. They had a permit. The left didn't have a permit, but the Nazis had a permit. And that's all Nazis need, apparently.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, Nazis are very organized, so of course they had a permit.
I think there are probably people in municipal government that office mates say, that one's a real permit Nazi.
Yes.
So it like completely goes together.
And meanwhile, the guy's holding a torch, and he's like, you don't know the half of it.
Do you feel like, have you had any sense that Donald Trump is watching the show or has seen the show?
I don't know if he watches the show. I know that we're about 2 weeks ahead of everything. In fact, in the conference today, he said something that's a catchphrase on our show where Trump's like, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, right? And he and the presser today, I think, actually went, oh boy. And I was like, but we have a catchphrase on the show. He starts every show. He goes, I'm the president. Can you believe it? Let's roll. And he, two weeks after the show premiered, he was in the Rose Garden for the healthcare, like his faux healthcare victory where he made all the Congress come stand behind him. And he literally turned and said, I'm the president. Can you believe it? And I was like, either he's watching or I have symbiotically melded with him like Spock in the Horda.
You,
who loves the Horda, guys?
So, it was your first episode of The Fire Truck, right? The premiere episode?
That was The Fire
Truck,
yeah.
So you were out on the street. You were
a dump truck.
You were improvising.
Yes.
And fully none of the scripted, and just randomly a truck went by. And I highly recommend everybody find this and watch it. It is, for my money, the funniest 2 minutes of television this year. And you basically gave a very, you brought us inside of Trump's psyche in this 2 minutes, and you basically very slowly unraveled.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you have some empathy in your performance Donald Trump.
I mean, as an actor, you have to have empathy for your character. And I think something people should understand, and they've confused, empathy is not sympathy. Sympathy would mean I identify with him and feel something for him. Empathy is almost a sort of ancient Judeo-Christian concept of I am a human, you are a human, we suffer from the same pain, and our paths through our pain are different. That's what empathy is. So, you know, he's a sad, lonely, self-loathing, love-seeking grub. I mean, that's who our president is.
Yeah.
And I think that when you look at him that way, it's like I'd rather go into his psyche and impersonate that. Anybody can stand there and go, I'm Donald Trump and do this. And anybody can do it. It's an Elvis. It's a Shatner. It's a very pat.
Look, as evidenced by the fact I do one.
Yes, that's right.
And that is the lowest. That is really the lowest bar. Yeah.
But, you know, so it's more the fact that you're going inside. What's the sadness inside of him that makes him so attracted to hate? And that's often the case. I mean, you see this weekend, this is about a self-loathing and a hatred that's turned outward because of the crisis within the white supremacy movement's self. And it's pathetic and dangerous. And his father's imposition on him to run the business and the awful relationship they had with each other including the number of African Americans they evicted in Brooklyn and Queens.
Without his father, what do you think he would be if he had sort of gotten adopted from another family and like got to live the life he wanted to live? What do you?
Well, I think I actually think he'd be like Ratso Rizzo and. Midnight Cowboy. I think if Trump didn't succeed, he'd live in a studio apartment filled with piles of newspapers and like old garbage in a sink that he never clears out. And he would wander around Times Square trying to steal money out of people's hot wallets.
Oh, that would be so much better.
It would be so much better.
But then you wouldn't have your show, and I probably wouldn't have mine.
No, we wouldn't work.
Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. Anthony, it's Anthony.
Hey, this is Kevin. I'm one of the producers here at Late Night. We're backstage with Anthony Atamanik, who does a fantastic Donald Trump on the President Show on Comedy Central. Anthony, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Kevin.
So you were saying that you guys run the office of the President Show like the Oval Office. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we try to run it like a White House in the sense that we obviously aren't there 7 days a week, but we... Because of the Trump's news is sort of like our crises, we have essentially like a threat assessment or a projection that's made by the research department of what paths the stories could take leading to Thursday, so that we have a sort of projection of what might happen. Right. We also get a daily news brief, and I get a daily schedule with mine and Trump's schedule paralleled so that I can find time to watch him and see what he's doing and saying. Then in addition to that, we sort of treat it that like the executive producers are like my senior cabinet members, and then the writers are sort of the advisors and sort of the machinations of the Oval, you know, and the White House at large. So, and then all the different departments of the show would sort of be the different departments of government, whether it's like education is research, and but they're all sort of there to serve me.
Sure.
And then I have my office as sort of the Oval. We structure our meetings and our interactions to sort of mirror what I would believe a presidency would operate like.
You guys tape your show on Thursdays.
Yes.
How far out do you start writing the show, and have you ever been caught in a situation where you had something planned and you had to really make changes last minute because of a breaking story that you tried to address on the show?
Every week we have to change it. We start working, you know, we actually will talk about themes and ideas weeks out, and then we'll just see which ones might. We always have sort of four or five options going into a Monday of where we might want to land, and then looking at how the themes can be sort of accessible. So, you know, if you're doing something like economy, or, I mean, we would never say economy, but like, let's say coup, like, you know, a military coup, but like coup, you know, we might be able to make that a coup in terms of a victory. We might mean make that a literal sort of like, what if the military takes over? So we like have options too. It's like improv. It's like taking the suggestion and seeing, how do you go around the suggestion in different ways to serve it as opposed to like dismissing the theme outright unless it really doesn't work? And then I think the hardest one we had was one was the mother episode. And that was where Trump, we basically did a Norman Bates where like Trump, like his mother's in his mind and she's taught, and Neil Casey did the voice. And we had this mother theme. And I, of course, can't really remember what the event was. I think it was the missiles. I think it might have been the missile attack. No, it was after the missile attack, but it was something. The point being that we had to really rewrite the show to make the theme fit, and it was probably the clearest example of square peg round hole. Uh-huh. And but we successfully did it, and it was actually, I think, a challenge. I think one of the benefits of doing a show like this is that although the scale of a television show is more money and obviously more access to resources, but to still approach this like this is like a theater show where there's edge and like risk, and that we're taking risk right up to Thursday in terms of how we fill the content in, makes it feel fun and fresh. So that's what I like about it.
You haven't really met any members of the administration, but you were at Politicon this year, right? And you went as Trump, right?
I mean, yes. I spoke as myself on a panel, and I did Trump.
Gotcha. And you met Roger Stone.
Yes.
What was that interaction like?
It was bizarre. You know, I've watched his the documentary on him.
Yeah.
And obviously know him from the Nixon days and know that he's like a, you know, master of dirty tricks and quite a serpentine person. And So I was kind of frightened to meet him. And also the proximity to Trump, like knowing how close he is and how close he is also in propagating that ideology that we witnessed in Virginia this weekend, like a dangerous character in my view. And but he was civil, and so I was civil to him. And but what was interesting was he said, "I love your impression." And I went, "Oh God." I said, "Really?" And he went, "Yeah." He said, "You, when you impersonate him, it's like his presence is in the room." And I was like, "Oh God." I was like, "I don't know how to take that." Yeah. But I took it as like, okay, that's, he knows the guy. So that felt pretty good. And then he's like leaned in, kind of grabbed my arm, and he went, "He knows." And I was like, "Oh God." And I was like, "What does that mean?" And so I left it at that, but I told him I wanted to get dinner with him, so I might follow up. And
fantastic.
I feel like you have to get closer and closer to the beast if you're going to do this, you know,
right.
Just to see,
right.
You know. Yeah.
Right. What's Politicon like?
If the correspondence dinner is nerd prom,
uh-huh.
Then this is like wherever the nerds who didn't go to prom go. It's a lot of news people,
uh-huh.
And you know, Joy Reid was there, okay. From MSNBC,
yeah.
Who I love.
Yeah.
She's the best. And you should tell your network to let her come on our show. but you know, there's a lot of like James Carville and you know, different political figures.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pundits and talking heads, panels and so on. It's sort of, you know, a Star Trek convention for politics, basically.
Yeah. Well, you guys have had great guests on your show.
Yes.
And you improvise. You're such a great improviser that when you're interviewing them as Trump, that's a chance for you to really improvise with the guests on your show.
Yes.
Is there a favorite guest that you've had on the 13 episodes that you guys have done so far?
Oh, man, that is a good question. I would say in terms of guests, there's two. I love all my guests. I was really engaged by Deepak Chopra,
uh-huh.
Because he was willing to participate in a bit.
Uh-huh.
So there was a part of it where I was just like, ah, I love that he's like doing a bit with us. And it was really great. It was funny to have Joy Behar on because
yeah.
She has such a relationship with Trump. And I really enjoyed her as a guest. And Joy is a wonderful person. So I love all my guests, Carol Radswell and Keith Olbermann, of course,
right.
I love. And he was our
first
guest,
right. Yeah.
And he'll come back. All of them are wonderful. But if I was to say in terms of just interest, things that were interesting to me and experience, those would be the two.
Yeah.
But they're all wonderful.
And congratulations on the show. You guys got another 7-episode extension.
More,
that's great.
Yeah, now we're cruising, hoping they, you know, give us a season 2.
Yeah.
That'll be the next thing.
Yeah.
More, as Donna Summer used to say.
Yeah.
Is it Donna Summer? More. How do you like it? No, that's not Donna Summer. Donna Summer was Love. I'll have to look it
we'll
up.
We'll fact check it.
Fact check,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we'll fact check it.
The wrong disco song.
It's definitely a disco song. Yeah.
More. Is it Peaches and Herb? No, that's Shake Your Groove thing.
Yes. We're going to find out. We'll keep all this.
please keep this part.
Yeah. Great. Well, congratulations on everything. And thank you for being here.
Oh,
you know,
dude.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Come back again.
I love it.
Super fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. Back at NBC after a long hiatus.
That's right.
You
all right. Great. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
One quick note about Seth's interview with filmmaker Brian Knappenberger you're about to hear. This was recorded earlier this month on August 9th, prior to recent news events. Please enjoy the interview.
Our guest is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. His latest film is Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press, which is streaming now on Netflix. Please welcome to the show, Brian Knappenberger, everybody. Here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating documentary that was about something that happened, which was this Hulk Hogan Gawker trial,
yeah,
which basically bankrupted Gawker.
Uh-huh.
But then the issues in it have sort of become a little bit more important now, maybe even than they were then. But tell us a little bit about what got you started on this story.
Yeah, I mean, I was really, really interested in this case, this sort of trial between Hulk Hogan and Gawker Media. I just thought it was interesting by itself. You know, this is the first time a sex tape case like this had ever gone to trial.
So they basically put the sex tape online.
Yes. Yeah, so Hulk Hogan was filmed having sex with the wife.
The key to a sex tape.
Key to a sex tape.
Yeah.
With the wife of his then best friend, Bubba the Love Sponge.
Right.
Who is a shock jock radio DJ in Florida. So this tape gets out there. A lot of people speculate about it. There's some stills posted, I think, on maybe on TMZ and some other site, The Dirty or something. And then eventually Gawker posts an edited down version of this tape along with a post. And that starts this this really lengthy kind of trial, this battle between them.
And during the trial, Hulk Hogan made a distinction between the character of Hulk Hogan and his actual the actual guy, Terry Bollea.
Yeah.
And because part of what Gawker argued was that they published this sex tape because it refuted things that Hulk Hogan had said about his own sexual prowess. Is that correct?
Yes. And this was a defense that the Hogan team brought. It was new to this trial. They hadn't even mentioned this in the previous incarnations of this, where they made a distinction between Hulk Hogan and the private person, Terry Bollea. And it was fascinating. I mean, basically, their argument, they said, look, you've talked about this sex tape, this sex incident many times on Howard Stern's show, in fact, in very graphic details. So why is this so private? Why, you know, you've actually brought this into the public. You've made it newsworthy yourself. And he said, well, that's different. That was me as Hulk Hogan bragging about my sex life. And that's different than me as Terry Bollea. And he actually asked about his, I don't know if you'd say this, 10-inch penis.
Yeah. And once you say 10-inch, they're going to finish it. Yeah.
And so that actually becomes a thing. And Hulk Hogan on the trial, or Mr. Bollea, says, actually, I don't have a 10-inch penis. Hulk Hogan does, but me, not so much, I guess.
This is a crazy, this sounds like just the craziest trial. And then Hulk Hogan wins this $50 million settlement. Was it 50?
It's $140
million. $140
million,
my goodness.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the initial verdict. So.
And so that bankrupts Gawker. Now, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, there are a lot of people that would say Gawker made some editorial choices that were sort of beyond what is considered journalism with dignity. But ultimately, the question is, do you also have to protect the free speech or the rights to the free press when they're doing things that you don't agree with? Is that the fear of press going forward? Is that, you know, Gawker basically was put out of business by this one decision? And that other people will use this same technique to take down any website or any news source that they don't like?
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. It's a complex story. And I think that's one of the reasons why I personally found it so compelling. It's not an easy story. I think I kind of found it interesting because it's difficult in some ways. And it is on the edges of acceptability with speech. It's a little like People versus Larry Flint kind of territory. But that dramatic verdict that actually silences Gawker, and then the revelation that Silicon Valley investor Peter Thiel was actually bankrolling Hulk Hogan's case the entire time in secret, that made it a very kind of different story. It became a story about how big money can silence critical voices.
So you mentioned Peter Thiel. He's this big Silicon Valley guy. He had personal gripes with Gawker.
That's right.
This was him using Hulk Hogan, who he did not have any relationship with, basically to take vengeance on Gawker. Interestingly, he's also a big part of the Trump campaign. He's a supporter of Donald Trump. Now we have a president who I feel has the same idea about the press that Peter Thiel had about Gawker. Is there a fear now that Donald Trump will be inspired by what happened with Gawker and that he will say, basically, if you have the legal team with more money, you can basically crush these smaller news sources?
Absolutely. I think there is a fear about that, this basic sort of chilling effect that it might have on news organizations. And part of it is that Peter Thiel did this in secret, right? So he went after these people in secret. And at the same time, you could never quite separate the case from this crazy election cycle. I mean, this is the same time Trump is saying, you know, pointing at the press and his rallies and speeches and saying, we're going to, you know, open up libel laws and sue you like you've never been sued before. I mean, he's calling the press scum and horrible, horrible people and all of that. So, and then, you know, Peter Thiel became a Trump supporter and all that. So, yeah, you know, the USA Today did a great story that looked at the 3,500 lawsuits that Trump is involved with. So I think it's a very real concern.
I find it very depressing that a media organization, any media organization, can be put out of business by a lawsuit. Yet there is, in this era of Trump, there are some, like, positive signs in journalism.
Yeah.
New York Times, Washington Post both have subscription bases going up. Do you feel like there's this unique opportunity now for, even at a time where they're under attack, for journalism to sort of rise up and maybe use this Trump moment and this time we're living in to be more robust?
Yeah, absolutely. I do actually think that's one of the sort of silver linings of this Trump era, this early time. I think people have, there's legitimate criticism of media that's gotten too corporatized over time, maybe gotten too cozy with power, that it trades, softball stories for access to power and celebrity. But, I think that you see the Washington Post and you see the New York Times and you see starting to see really great journalism. So there's like this, they're kind of remembering what the press is there for. I mean, look, the journalism is almost by definition something that makes powerful people uncomfortable. And that's the point, right? Speaking truth to power is the point. And we need this in a participatory democracy. So I think if we're sort of remembering what that's all about, why it's important, that could be actually be a good thing.
Well, I hope that comes to pass. And congratulations on the documentary. It's a great story, very well told.
Thank you very much.
Brian Nattenberger, everybody. Nobody Speak is streaming now on Netflix.
Hey everybody, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Brian Nattenberger, the director of Nobody Speak. You and Seth were just talking about Trump's relationship to the press. I wanted to ask about your reaction to some recent Trump media news. So there's this Vice report earlier this week that twice a day the president gets good news stories printed out and delivered to him. As someone who has kind of covered Trump and the press, what was your reaction to that story?
I mean, it's just an astonishing story that came out this week, that twice daily he gets news reports that are supposed to be all positive. And the only, I guess, apparently the only feedback that they've ever gotten is like, make it more positive. I'm quoting.
Yeah, it's true.
And so, I mean, that's just bizarre and kind of pathetic, to be honest. I mean, it's a little funny, but it's also a little terrifying.
Right.
I mean, I thought the funniest thing that people said about that was that, I think David Axelrod or somebody said, if we did that with Obama, he would have thought it was, an April Fool's joke
right.
or something.
Right.
It seems a little like an April Fool's
it does.
Joke. It's a non-reality-based bubble he's in.
Speaking of non-reality bubbles, the other big Trump news story this week was the launch of Trump TV. What was your reaction to seeing? I mean, it seems like state television in many senses.
Yeah.
It's them putting out their own real news.
Yeah, it's another one of those stories, Trump TV, that you'd think was pretty funny, except it's also disturbing if you really kind of think a little bit, deeper about it. I mean, it's, he's saying this is, in his mind, fair and balanced, truthful stuff. But I mean, it's straight up, it's a page out of the authoritarian textbook, go around everybody else, just create a kind of state media that's only your propaganda.
Right.
I mean, that really does not, that has nothing to do with journalism in any kind of real sense.
Sure.
That journalism is what powerful people don't want you to hear. Everything else is basically propaganda.
Right.
And, that quote, which is a famous sort of newspaper quote, probably never more apt than here.
Yeah. I wanted to ask also about another big piece of the documentary. It's this secret purchase of the Las Vegas Review-Journal right. by Sheldon Adelson, this big casino business guy out in Las Vegas. He does it secretly. The reporters there have to report out their own story about who their new boss is. So you cover a lot of different topics in the documentary. I'm wondering how much you kind of plan out when you start the documentary from the beginning. Do you leave room for yourself to discover a lot of things once production has begun?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of being really well prepared before I go into something, to really doing as much research as we can in terms of when events happened and what they mean and all of that. And I do a lot of pre-interviews. But I also kind of do that really for the purpose of being able to kind of change directions if events change directions. I think you can do that better if you're more prepared.
Right.
So I guess to answer your question, a little bit of both. But man, this documentary took some wild twists and turns in ways that I'd hadn't experienced before that.
Well, back to the president. You cover him a lot in the documentary, and you say the president's attacks on the press are kind of a cautionary tale. So what was it like when he was elected?
The election of Donald Trump was one of the weirdest things I've ever experienced as a filmmaker, because Trump was in our film throughout the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, as the trial is going on, in the news, Trump is going through the primaries and then winning the Republican primary and going into the general election. And he's really, a lot of this is fueled by a kind of hatred of the press that echoed in a strange way the Hulk Hogan and Gawker trial. So we were looking, including, by the way, the issue of puffery. People would say, Trump has said all these awful misogynistic things, but some of his surrogates would say, well, look, he just said that as a television character.
The character, yeah.
With the implication that you can't hold him responsible for what he said on TV, which is a very strange kind of thing. But so we were exploring that the whole time. But we walked into the offices the day after the election. And I mean, everybody's very people on the street were emotional before we even got to the office. But watching that the film in a rough cut stage was very strange. It was very clear we were making a very different feature than we thought we were. It was cautionary before, and then it went from cautionary to like, holy now what? And now what do we do?
Yeah. Well, I think we're all kind of still asking that question.
I think everybody has.
We're still in that moment, I think. It's a constant place in time. Congrats on the film, and thank you so much for being here. Such a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.